Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're looking at a text that honestly still feels incredibly powerful and relevant. Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham jail. Just picture it for a second. It's April 1963. King's in a jail cell in Birmingham, Alabama. He's been arrested during a nonviolent protest. And from there, he writes this. This incredibly articulate defense of civil disobedience. It tackles huge questions about justice, law, morality. And these aren't just, you know, academic questions. They hit just as hard today.
They really do. And that's our goal for you in this deep dive. We want to unpack King's core arguments, understand why he was the person to make them, look at the philosophy behind his resistance, and then crucially connect it all back to today. So
yes.
You walk away feeling you really get this this foundational piece of writing.
Okay, so let's start with the man himself, Martin Luther King Jr. Who was he beyond the icon? What gave him that unique authority to write something like this, especially from jail?
Well, Martin Luther King Jr., born in Atlanta back in 1929, he wasn't just a charismatic leader, though he certainly was that. He was a Baptist minister, yes, but he also held a PhD in systematic theology from Boston University. So his background was deeply intellectual, deeply spiritual. His arguments weren't just emotional appeals. They were really carefully constructed, drawing on philosophy, theology.
Specific influences.
Oh, definitely. Things like personalism, this idea emphasizing the inherent worth of every single person. And the social gospel movement, pushing Christians to apply their ethics to social problems like poverty, inequality, and of course, Mahatma Gandhi. King brilliantly adapted Gandhi's nonviolent resistance, his satyagraha, you know, truth force for the American civil rights struggle.
And it's so key that he wasn't just an academic thinking about these things in theory. He was out there leading the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the SCLC. He had already led huge campaigns, like the Montgomery bus boycott. So he had the ideas, yes, but also the real-world practical experience. He'd actually put these nonviolent principles into action, often at great personal risk.
Exactly. That lived experience is crucial. And the context for the letter itself really highlights this. It was a direct reply to that public statement, a call for unity, from 8 white clergymen in Alabama. They criticized him for being there, called his methods unwise, even labeled him an outside agitator.
An outsider, right?
Yeah. And King is literally writing his response from a jail cell. I mean, talk about embodying your principles. It showed his commitment wasn't just talk. It was deeply personal.
Okay, so those clergymen called his actions unwise and untimely. Pretty direct criticism. How did King push back? How did he argue that direct action was necessary right then and there?
He was incredibly methodical about it. He laid out these 4 basic steps for any nonviolent campaign, and he always stressed, you know, direct action was the last resort, not the first thing you jump to.
Okay, what were the steps?
First, collection of the facts. You have to determine if injustice actually exists. And King, well, he just listed Birmingham's awful track record. The segregation, the police brutality, all those unsolved bombings of black homes, churches. The facts were stark.
Hard to argue with.
Then second, negotiation. He described how they had tried again and again in good faith to talk with city leaders, with business owners. But promises were broken, like taking down those humiliating segregation signs.
So the trust just wasn't there.
Completely eroded. Third was self-purification. This was about preparing the activists spiritually and emotionally. They'd workshop it, asking themselves tough questions. Can you take blows without hitting back? Can you handle jail?
Wow, that shows incredible discipline.
It does. It wasn't about wanting to suffer, but about being ready, about committing fully to nonviolence, even when provoked. And only then, only after those first 3 steps failed, did they move to direct action. And the point, King made clear, wasn't to stir up violence. It was, and this is his phrase, to create a situation so crisis-packed that it will inevitably open the door to negotiation.
That leads right into this idea he introduces, which sounds a bit jarring at first. Creative tension. What did he mean by that? It wasn't about creating chaos, was it?
No, not chaos. Creative tension, for Ping, was about deliberately disrupting a false sense of peace. It's a constructive tension designed to force a community to finally face an issue it's been ignoring.
So making people uncomfortable, essentially.
Yes, uncomfortable, but for growth. He compared it to like lancing a boil. You need to bring the infection, the hidden injustice, out into the open so it can actually heal. It forces a moral confrontation, makes the problem impossible to ignore any longer.
So he lays out the practical strategy, the steps, the idea of creative tension. But then the letter goes deeper, right, into the philosophy of it all. He tackles that charge of being a lawbreaker head on. How does he justify breaking the law?
Yeah, this is where it gets really profound. He draws this critical distinction between just laws and unjust laws. He even quotes St. Augustine, "An unjust law is no law at all."
Strong words.
Very. He argues we have a moral duty to obey just laws, sure. But, he says, we have an equally strong moral duty to disobey unjust laws.
How did he define the difference? How do you know which is which?
He gave pretty clear definitions. A just law, he said, is a man-made rule that aligns with the moral law, or the law of God. It's a law that uplifts human personality. An unjust law, conversely, is out of sync with moral law. It degrades human personality. And segregation was his prime example. Why? Because it distorts the soul and damages the personality, hurting both the person discriminating and the person being discriminated against.
That's a powerful way to put it.
He also added some democratic checks, like a law is unjust if a majority forces it on a minority but doesn't have to follow it themselves, or if it's forced on people who didn't even have the right to vote on it.
But he wasn't advocating anarchy. There was a specific way you had to break these unjust laws, right?
Absolutely crucial point. He insisted it must be done openly, lovingly, and with a willingness to accept the penalty. This wasn't about sneaking around or avoiding consequences. By accepting the penalty, you actually show the highest respect for the idea of law, even while protesting a specific bad law. The goal was to prick the conscience of the community.
Make them see the injustice.
Exactly. And he points out this isn't some crazy new idea. He connects it back through history. Think of Socrates acting as a gadfly in Athens, or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the Bible, refusing the king's unjust order. Even the Boston Tea Party fits this pattern of resisting unjust rules.
It's fascinating how he frames it within tradition. Now, King saves some really sharp criticism, maybe his sharpest, not for the obvious opponents like the KKK, but for the people who said they supported his goals, but not his methods. The white moderates.
Yes, his grave disappointment with the white moderate is probably one of the most quoted and maybe most challenging parts of the letter. He says, "The Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate."
That's a radical claim. Why? What was the issue with the moderate?
His argument was that the moderate is often more devoted to order than to justice. They prefer that negative peace, which is just the absence of visible tension, over the positive peace, which requires the actual presence of justice. They'd say things like, "I agree with your goal, but I can't support your methods of direct action," or they'd paternalistically tell black people to wait, that they could set the timetable for someone else's freedom.
And King powerfully argues why wait was simply not an option. He says for the oppressed, wait almost always means never. He gives these gut-wrenching examples.
He does. It's like a litany of pain, explaining this legitimate and unavoidable impatience. He talks about seeing mobs lynch your parents, seeing police curse, kick, even kill your black brothers and sisters with impunity. Trying to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park because it's closed to colored children. Seeing the clouds of inferiority beginning to form in her little mental sky. The constant humiliation of white and colored signs.
It just paints such a vivid picture of why patience had run out.
Exactly. It shows why waiting wasn't just inconvenient, it was morally devastating.
And then, as a minister himself, he turns to the white church. His disappointment there seems almost personal, doesn't it?
Yeah, deeply personal and deeply felt. He expected the church, especially the white church in the South, to be allies, to stand up for justice based on their own stated beliefs. Instead, he found many were silent, or worse, actively condemned the movement. He accused them of offering just pious irrelevancies and sanctimonious trivialities instead of real moral leadership.
He used that analogy, the thermometer and the thermostat.
Right, a brilliant analogy. He said the church shouldn't just be a thermometer, passively reflecting society's attitudes and prejudices. It should be a thermostat, actively working to change and elevate society's moral climate. He felt it was failing that core prophetic mission.
So they called him an extremist. But instead of defensively rejecting that label, he kind of flips it, doesn't he? He reclaims it.
He totally reframes it. He says, essentially, the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be. That's the real choice.
Extremists for hate or extremists for love?
Precisely. Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? He forces you to confront what you're actually extreme about. Then he aligns himself with figures history now reveres as moral extremists. Jesus, an extremist for love. Amos, an extremist for justice. Paul, Martin Luther, Lincoln, Jefferson.
It's such a smart rhetorical move.
It really is. It shows that standing up for fundamental rights, for moral progress, often looks extreme to the comfortable status quo at the time.
And tied into this, he talks about suffering, not just enduring suffering, but almost using it, this idea of redemptive suffering. How did that fit into his philosophy of change?
It's a complex idea, drawing from his Christian faith and also from Gandhi's Satyagraha. He saw the voluntary acceptance of suffering, going to jail peacefully, accepting blows without fighting back as having a powerful transformative effect. The idea was that this unearned suffering, endured lovingly, could awaken the conscience of the oppressors. It wasn't about seeking pain for its own sake, but about demonstrating the moral seriousness of the cause and hoping to reach the humanity of those upholding the unjust system. It could break down barriers and open the door to reconciliation.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground here. Think about our listener today. What are the absolute key takeaways from the letter from Birmingham Jail that still speak to us that we need to grapple with now?
Well, there are several that feel incredibly urgent. First, I'd say it's the moral imperative. King insists we have a moral duty to resist injustice. It's not just an option. It's fundamental to our own dignity. We have to act.
It's a call to action, not passive agreement.
Exactly. Second, interconnectedness. That famous line, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We can't isolate ourselves. What happens to others affects us. Neutrality isn't really an option when injustice is happening.
Right. Third,
the urgency of now. Remember, justice too long delayed is justice denied. Change doesn't just happen if we wait politely. It takes constant active pressure. Time itself doesn't fix things. People's actions do.
And the last one,
the danger of complacency. Maybe the most uncomfortable one. King warned about the appalling silence of the good people. He's saying that inaction, silence in the face of wrong, is itself a form of complicity. We have to examine our own silence.
Those are powerful. And they're not just abstract ideas. They have real-world applications for us, don't they?
Absolutely. Think about personal ethics. King's framework for judging laws, does it uplift or degrade personality? That can help us navigate moral choices in our own lives, big and small.
Like whistleblowing, or just how we engage in our communities.
Right. Or think about organizations, workplaces, that idea of negative peace versus positive peace. Is our workplace quiet because issues are suppressed or because there's genuine justice and equity? Sometimes you need that creative tension to force necessary change.
Makes sense.
And for social movements today, those four steps, fact-finding, negotiation, self-purification, direct action, there's still a relevant playbook for activism on any issue, from climate change to human rights.
And maybe even just how we talk to each other.
Yes. His approach in the letter, respectful, clear, but absolutely firm and morally grounded, it's a model for how we might engage in difficult conversations across deep divides, something we desperately need today. You know, looking at the bigger picture, this letter really challenges all of us. Mm-hmm. It asks us to look past the surface, past just keeping things orderly, and really ask, is this right?
It definitely pushes us to think about our own lives.
Yeah.
What risks are we willing to take for what we believe is right? Could our own desire for comfort, our own moderation, actually be helping to keep unjust systems in place? Are we being thermometers or thermostats?
That's the core of it. The letter insists that justice isn't something that just exists. It's something we have to actively build, constantly pursue. And that takes courage, it takes wisdom, and yeah, it takes that willingness to speak truth, even when it's uncomfortable, even when it's risky.
A really powerful challenge to end on, something for all of us to think about. We hope this deep dive into Letter from Birmingham Jail has given you some fresh perspectives and valuable insights. Until next time, keep digging deeper.